Today is the 14th of December 2011. This is the Pioneers of the Fringe Oral History Project. Today I'm interviewing Maurice Toolidge at Durham Green, Menangle Road, Menangle. Your full name?
Maurice Kevin Toolidge.
And your date of birth and place of birth?
6/10/1947, Liverpool.
And your parents' full names?
Mary Toolidge and Ivan or John Toolidge.
And where was John born?
John was born in Korchula, which is off the coast of Dubrovnik in the Dalmatian coast.
And do you know what year your father was born?
1926, I think. I can't remember.
And Mary's place of birth?
She was born in, can't ever pronounce it,
we'll translate that.
She's now 87.
Okay. And your father passed away, what year did he pass away?
2007.
We'll talk about the rest of your family as we go on.
Yeah.
So, we'll edit this bit out, but just watch the hand rubbing and the sleeves. It picks up really.
Oh, sorry.
No, don't be sorry. I just have to say it to everybody, but relax. Try and relax. Yep. But just watch. Yep. You. So, Maurice, what are some of your earliest memories on, and talk about that first property as a young boy?
My first memories are of Green Valley, being brought up in Green Valley Road, Green Valley, where my parents lived with my grandparents, Marianne and Jouva Toolidge. I can remember the old wooden house, which no longer is there. I can remember going to my first school at Green Valley School, not being able to speak a word of English, and having difficulty communicating with other people. I also remember the horses that my dad used to tend to on that particular property for use on the farm. From there, I then progressed to Kookaburra Road, Preston, where I lived with my father, whose property was adjacent to my grandfather, who also moved there from Green Valley. My parents owned 20 acres. My grandfather owned 21 acres.
How old were you when you moved to Preston?
I was 5 years old. That would have been in 1952.
And your uncle Peter, did he have land there?
He also later bought land adjacent on the opposite side of my grandfather. I can't remember what year it was, but it wasn't too long after that. He bought 15 acres. And my father actually purchased the land from my uncle, not my uncle, from his relative, who was Tony Toolidge. And he also happened to organise my parents' get together, so that they eventually became married.
Okay, I might just take you back to Green Valley for a bit, because there are photographs from Green Valley that feature your father and his cousin. And his sisters carrying cabbages. Do you remember, do you have any memories there of?
The main memories that I have of there is the packing shed. It was an old wooden packing shed. I also remember my uncle had a little place further up where he lived. It was an old sort of garage. The other memory I have is of a fellow that used to come on the farm and work for us. His name was Brian Axum, and he was taken on. He had a disability, a mental disability, but my parents and my uncle took him on to help him survive, I suppose.
Do you remember any of your neighbours then?
He was one of the neighbours.
Yes.
Axum. There was another neighbour, a couple of other neighbours that I remember going to with my father and my uncle. One was the Hornsey Farm. I can't remember the owner. We used to go there and collect manure for the market garden. And there was another Yugoslav gentleman on the opposite side of us who used to grow tomatoes. I can't remember his name offhand now, but he used to drive a motorbike. But he used to be a bit of a character as well in the local area.
And do you remember the Costas at all?
Yes, I do remember the Costas, but that came later when I was at Kookaburra Road. Okay. I met up with the Costas.
Okay. So should we move to Kookaburra Road?
Yeah.
And so do you mind if we just repeat? Your father bought the land from your uncle, his uncle, did he?
He bought it from... I think it's his cousin, but they used to call him, I think, Uncle Tony. Tule was his nickname. He owned a lot of land in Kookaburra Road up to the, which is now Camden Valley Way. In those days, it used to be the Hume Highway. He kept 20 acres and sold my dad 20 acres.
When did your grandparents come out to Australia?
My grandfather came out in April 1928. Both grandfathers came out in April 1928. My grandfather on my father's side stayed in Sydney, and my grandfather on my mother's side went up to Maribyrnong, North Queensland. He walked up there, as I understand it, and he then started picking tobacco, and then eventually bought a farm in Mossman, North Queensland. My grandmother came out in... my grandmother and the two sons came out in 1935 or 33, and then followed by my aunties. My mother came out in 1933 or 1935 at the age of 7, but went straight to North Queensland with her mother.
What do you remember about the romance of your parents meeting from their stories?
What I remember was that my uncle Tule, as he was then called, organised the introductions. He took my father to North Queensland to meet Mum. They met, and from there the romance started. They got engaged at Mossman Gorge, as I understand it, and then they got married in Mossman. They then came down. Their honeymoon was on the train coming down from Mossman to Sydney or to Green Valley at that time, and then immediately they went straight onto the farm working. They did have a big party. Apparently everybody still talked about it, where all the locals were involved. They did at Hoxton Park, I think it was. They had a big, big festive, which was catered for and cooked by a gentleman who owned a restaurant. I just can't, his name eludes me at the moment, but we'll get it. He owned the restaurant in Camden Valley Way and between Cowpasture Road there many, many years ago.
So what year were they married, do you recall?
1946.
What sort of man was your father? What were your earliest memories of him?
My father was probably a traditional dad. He wasn't a dad that spent a lot of time with me in terms of facilitating a relationship, like a father and son relationship. Dad was more of a dad that you followed by example. He would set the example and you would follow it. He was very honest, very hardworking, very family minded. probably was a bit of a traditionalist, loved the farm, loved the agricultural side of the world and growing things. And I think in a way he anticipated that I would follow in his footsteps. However, I never saw the, and we clashed on this, where he tried to do things more on a old style. I tried to introduce new styles of agriculture. But many times we would clash, but we worked together very well. I always had a very respecting relationship, and he always treated me in a very responsible way. In fact, I used to drive the tractor at the age of 9. I used to drive the truck at the age of 12, 13. I used to drive the truck to the markets at the age of 15. So he put a lot of responsibility on me in that regard. Wanted me to be educated, which was good, but unfortunately I probably wasn't the smartest guy around, but anyway, academically that is.
Academically, yeah. Yeah. Well, you might not have been interested.
True, reading was always a difficulty. Yes. Maybe this came from the fact that I didn't know English until the age of 5 or 6, and then was just, I just picked it up as I went along.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment too. Your father, I remember telling a story I recorded before he passed on about carrying a plough on his back from Smithfield to Green Valley to plough. They used to borrow the plough. Yeah. Do you recall any of that?
I don't recall it because it happened early. I think that was even when I was about 5 or 6 years of age, but I do recall him talking about it. And how they used to do very different things to what we would do today. They used to carry ploughs. I did hear that story, but I didn't actually see it.
Did he have problems physically as a result of that hard labour?
He did. I can remember on numerous occasions during farming, he would. He was the type of man that would be called into action straight away. So he had a tractor, a little 5-horsepower tractor that used to get bogged in the paddock. He would immediately try and lift it out, and without thinking, he would go ahead and lift it. And as a result of that, he did get a slip disc at one stage. And I can remember him being laid up for a couple of months, and actually I had to walk on his back to try and relieve the pain in his back.
And how old were you then?
I would have been probably around 10, 12.
Because you're very physical, aren't you, the men in your family? You're very
Everybody,
physical.
Yeah. We all particularly physical in terms of, even though my dad was a small man, but very, very strong and very physically fit, could work all day to all hours of the night, get up early in the morning and continue. And in fact, in a lot of, from probably the age of 12 on to the age of 25, even longer, he used to work 2 jobs. One was the farm and the other one was the water board. And they would work, and he actually had a reputation that because they were on the maintenance crew where pipes were broken and people were required to dig manually because there was no tractors available, he'd be the first man selected because he was the one that would dig the most and get the job done. In fact, I can remember when I first got married and moved to Preston's with my wife. We bought a house from Dr. Double Brown for $250 and transported it to Kookaburra Road. And I had to put an electrical pole in the ground. And I couldn't afford to get a tractor to do it. So my dad actually dug the hole for the telegraph pole, which was approximately 6 foot, had to be 6 foot deep, which he did. Then he put the pole on the truck and then put the pole up and packed it in and by himself, without any support of anybody else.
It's quite symbolic, isn't it?
It's just unreal. I don't think anybody today would even consider that.
So the farm at Preston's was significant for you, obviously, and we'll cover that as we speak because of you now have a retirement village on that land. So
Well, the actual retirement village is not on my dad's land. The retirement village is actually on my grandfather's land, which was adjacent to dad's land. Yes, it is symbolic to me because that's where I grew up. There was a lot of happy times, particularly with mum and dad and all the people that used to visit, because they had a understanding where people would come and when the tomatoes or the cabbages had to be tended to, they would all come and help, and my dad would reciprocate. And that was sort of an acceptance and almost a social event as well as a working event. And I used to enjoy those times because there used to be a lot of laughter, particularly with my Yelovich cousins. A lot of laughter, a lot of happiness. We would have talks, particularly a lot of social events, like in discussion over meals. And I would sit and listen to that. And I learned a lot, in particular from my grandfather, listening about Cortula and how he grew up there and how he used to go from the township of Blato and then go across to his land on the coast, and they would have their holidays there.
So what do you remember about, what were some of those stories that your grandfather, do you remember, is there one, a story that stands out?
Well, in particular, the main story was that in the early years, well, before he moved to Australia, my father would follow him and his father, Ivan, because my grandfather was Marin and his father was Ivan, and my dad was, being the first son, was called after the grandfather. They would walk from Blato across to Cortula with the donkey, and my dad would be actually helped build a hut, that apparently is still standing, or it's in various positions of disrepair. The land is still in their name. They used to tend to grapes and figs, and they used to spend the summer there fishing. So that was probably, and they actually used to explain where it was in relation to Blato. And when I went back there in 2000, I could actually remember what they talked about, and it came to light, all those memories that they used to relate to. And what I saw in my mind actually became a reality, exactly as it was. So that was quite emotional when I actually went there to see that and to follow their tracks.
So can you talk about what they grew at Preston's?
Yes, at Preston's they grew mainly tomatoes. My grandfather bought the property there first because it was high, so it would miss the early frosts, and frost was a big impediment to tomatoes coming on the market early. So they had to plant their tomatoes to get them in there first. The practice was that they'd plant around they start cultivating the land around July, start planting in August. They would tend to the land to make it into a what they called a bed. They would then put wires up, and then they would put hessian on the wires, and then they would plant the tomatoes, and that way it would assist the tomato from being affected by the frost. So on many occasions, the wind would blow during the day, throw the bags off, the hessian off, you would have to go up there and make sure the hessian was on, because if it was a clear night and the moon was out, there was more than likely there would be a frost, and the tomatoes would be affected if they weren't covered. And then by the time they got them to market, they would try and get them there by early December, end of November, and that's when the big prices were on. However, invariably during that period of growth, there would be other things that would affect it, such as hail. And many occasions I would see my grandfather or my father being totally distraught as a result of a hailstorm coming over the top. And in one occasion, I was probably around the ages of 12 or 13, I can remember my grandfather actually losing it. He had this crop ready. The market was at its best price. Hail came across and just wiped it out completely. And during the hailstorm, he went outside, picked up anything that he could find and started throwing it back at the sky. And it was landing on the shed, the packing shed. And he was just swearing in Yugoslav, complaining, just absolutely beside himself. And I was quite distraught because I could see I could feel his anger and his disappointment. But then I can remember him, they all sat around, had a cup of tea, a glass of wine. Next morning they got up, started working again, and knocked the tomatoes down and replanted them.
Amazing.
Yeah, but I think that all formulated my understanding of life and what hardships you can go through but you don't get affected by the hardship, you start again.
Your mother talks very fondly of your father.
Mm-hmm.
So they must have had a happy marriage.
Yeah, they did. They did. They had an unusual marriage. When you compare it to the modern day marriage, definitely. He read, but he didn't write. So mum did all the book work, which at that time was, for me, probably a little bit unusual, but mum was the more literate one because she went to school and read, whereas dad, he had the opportunity, got here when he was 14, didn't like school, and sort of was a shoemaker, I think he trained himself up to be. They had a lot of good times. We had a lot of good times with them. It was hard. We never had any money. I can remember the difficult mum's anxiety. We never had a lawn, we never had flowers, because we just spent our time on the market garden. And we were very poor, but very happy. I used to look after my brothers and sisters while mum would tend to the tomatoes when I was young. But we all bogged in and did the thing. But mum and dad had a very good relationship, and it lasted 60 years.
Tomato plants did your family have, and your grandfather, and then your uncle?
Well, from memories, and I couldn't verify these, but I used to hear them talking that we had up to 30,000 plants between the three farms, because they actually joined up to work all together at one stage. Particularly, I think that was in the early 60s when the Lippington Co-op was formed, and they used to send tomatoes to Perth, Melbourne, in particular Brisbane and South Australia, and I think at some occasions to New Zealand. From memory, they used to say that in the early 60s that the Preston's area and the Leppington area were the biggest tomato growing area in the Southern Hemisphere. And so they joined up, and I think at times they had 30,000 plants under cultivation at any one time in the summer period. And I can remember working my butt off at a very young age. They used to pick the tomatoes, and I used to put the tomato tins, which were onto the back of Uncle Peter's ute, and take them to the packing shed, and they used to pack them. And that was sort of my job, plus watering, putting manure in. These were all early ages of 14 or 15. And I used to have competitions in my mind to see how many tins I could pick up at one stage to carry on. And I think it used to hold me in good stead for football and all those things that the Anglos used to do at school, which held me in good stead there.
So who were some of your parents' dear friends? Who came to the house?
Mainly my uncles and aunties, all the cousins, the Eloviches, the Kalagurgoviches, the Suroviches, the Tuliches. They were because of their age groups and the brothers and sister connection, they used to visit on a regular basis, and we used to visit their place, particularly on birthdays, particularly my grandparents' birthdays, Marine and Juva. We all used to get together and join, and Christmas times was a big thing.
What do you remember about driving to the market? Can you describe the market and your...
Well, the market originally that I went to was at Haymarket, We used to go there. I can remember driving there with Dad, driving at serious stages early in the morning, loaded with cabbages. You'd pull up, and then he'd find a particular space on a concrete slab where he would reverse the truck into, and from there he would sell the products to any buyers, usually shop owners and agents from regional areas that used to come and buy the goods. And I used to be standing there, we'd unload, and then I'd be standing there trying to sell with him. And he used to give me directions as to what to sell and how much to sell for.
What did he say?
He would say, right, these are the premium, or the, in his words, were these were the best ones, they're the larger ones, so you sell those either one, I don't know, it was 1 shilling, I can't remember the exact amounts, and then $1 for a pound for a dozen and things of that nature, and then I'd have to remember, and then I'd have to calculate the money, which I soon learnt to work out what how much money was worth and what wasn't worth. There were very interesting people that we used to meet there, particularly the Rogleys and other Anniches, who would all be there, and they'd all have their discussion and their coffee before they'd start, because the market would open up at 6 and that's when they'd start selling. And then you'd stay there till 10, and on great days you would have sold everything. On really bad days, which were often, you would only sell half the load, you'd reload it and then take it back home and then give it to the cows. And that was pretty distraught. This went on for, I think, a fair while, and then it was, you went through the seasons, usually cabbages, cauliflowers and broad beans in the winter time. And then in the summertime, it was tomatoes, lettuce that you would be taking to the market. Then after that, they then moved to selling it through agents rather than them going to the markets and selling it, because it just became impossible with the fact that they were working on the water board and also had the farm to tend to. So they used to sell it with agents, but that was sort of later in the 70s.
So, I was just going to ask something.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. While I'm just regrouping myself, let's talk about your brothers and sisters and their full names.
So. Okay. My sister, which is 2 years younger than me, is Jeanette Toolich at that time. There was Jeanette Harpley. And my brother is Anthony David Toolich, who's... They went to school with me at Austral, then went off into high school at Liverpool Girls High. My sister did, and my brother went to Helston Agricultural School. We had a lot of good times, particularly my brother. I think I stressed him out. We used to have a lot of fights between each other. He used to always be trying to beat me, which he eventually did, but in the early days I used to win. We used to drive the tractor around the farm, and at one stage, I can remember at the age of 6, I was 12. I used to do derbies in the back paddocks, and he one day was sitting on the back of the tractor, fell off and smashed his head, cracked his skull, or cut his skull rather, and was bleeding profusely. We went back to where my mum and dad was, and I told him not to say anything about it, but it was a bit difficult because there was blood everywhere. So I don't think he was very happy about that.
Yes. I remember where I was going then, but I'll come back to stay with this, because you like cars, and I've heard you talk about, were there truck races? And
there was tractor races, which were held at Leppington Hall. Can't remember the year, but it must have been very early because I was quite young. I would say it was early 60s, and all the farmers would get their tractors, Ferguson's, Ford's, Fordson's, and there were so many different other names, and they would set up a mud track in around the Leppington Hall, and they would all then test their abilities as to who was the fastest, and that that used to be quite an interesting, and that was a day occasion that everybody sort of went to.
And were there any standout drivers that you remember?
I can't remember. I think the one that stood out for me was probably Johnny Marcovina. He was always the one who was a farmer who lived directly opposite Peter. And she, his wife used to take us to the church. She was very much into religion, the Catholic religion, and she used to take us to church every Sunday and also assisted us in being, is it confirmed? Yeah, confirmed, for our confirmations.
And what's your confirmation name?
I wouldn't have a clue, sorry.
It's all right. so you, I remember hearing you talk about cooking and how they, your mother would cook seasonally with what was available.
Yeah, she would, and she would cook as if there was no tomorrow. Anybody that would be there, there would always be food on the table and more than sufficient. And she used to make meals out of nothing, which was just amazing. There was no recipe books, there was nothing, yet whatever she produced was just so tasting, so filling, and everybody used to enjoy it. And that would vary from the simple tomato, egg, onion concoction that you would do to tripe and a tripe stew to a fish stew to a fish soup, which my dad absolutely adored, and because he would spend much time eating the head of the fish, which he always said was the best.
So did you have chooks and things as well as?
Yes, we used to have the memories of my chicken days was the chooks were very much free range. They would lay their eggs wherever and around the house, anywhere you find eggs everywhere. But the biggest occasion was when Christmas time came. You actually were able to kill a chook and have it for Christmas, and that was the big occasion. We used to spend our Christmases with the Yellowbitches at Gadamatta Bay every Christmas, that without fail. We would have to kill half a dozen chooks, which was a big thing. My dad would chop their heads off with the cane chainsaw, and they would run around and without their heads on, which was sort of very exciting for the young kids. Then we'd put them in the big copper, then we'd take the feathers off, and then Mum would breadcrumb them or cook them in various ways. And that was sort of the Christmas festivity.
So just thinking about your house at Preston's, can you describe the house you lived in?
Yes, I can. It was a fibro house, fibro clad house. It was very basic. It had a kitchen, living room all in one, had a lounge room and three bedrooms and one bathroom. On the veranda, it had three bedrooms but no lounge room. And on the veranda, we ended up making a bedroom out of that, which my brother and myself slept in. The one bedroom was converted into a lounge room, and the other bedroom was for my sister. The furniture was very, very basic. We never had a TV when we grew up until I think I was about 15. The main thing in the kitchen was the table with the stove and the refrigerator. They sort of stood out, and everything revolved around that area. It was just Mum would be in the kitchen, we'd be coming home from school, she'd be there waiting for us. She'd always have a bottle of milk because Dad used to milk the cow. And then I used to love the fact that it was so fresh, and then I'd like it cold when I'd get home, and she'd put Ovaltine or Milo on the bottom and the milk on top, and then I'd shake it and drink it every afternoon after I got home from school.
That's a lovely memory, isn't it? Would your grandparents live in a separate house?
My grandparents lived in the property adjacent to us. They had a new house, that was like it was next door, but being next door, you're talking about 500 metres away. We used to, as kids, go and meet with my grandmother and have social occasions with them on a regular basis. And in my later years at the high school, I spent the last 2 years of living in their place because of 2 reasons. One, our house was very small and I couldn't study. So, and the other reason was my parents were getting older and they wanted somebody to look after them because they felt insecure.
So your grandparents were getting older and you cared for them?
I didn't actually care for them, but I was just there if they needed me. I was sort of the gopher. If anything happened, I would then go and contact my parents or my uncle that they would need help, and then they would provide the help.
What school did you go to in high school?
I went to the famous school called Liverpool Boys High. Back in 1960, it was you'd catch a bus from the top of Kookaburra Road and Hume Highway in those days, and that bus would take you to Liverpool Station. You would get off at Liverpool Station, then you would walk down through the park, big park, to the school. The girls would go in one school and the boys would go into the other school. But they were probably the better years of my life because I then was introduced to sport, rugby, soccer, cricket, and I used to just enjoy sport. And
so we might talk about that too. Mm. Had you have a mobile phone in your pocket?
No.
You don't?
I've got it on the floor.
Because it's picking up, the static picks up, unfortunately.
Sorry.
No, that's all right, because I turned mine off, but
it's amazing. It's just coming through on the recording.
Is it?
Yeah.
Would it be all right out here?
Yeah.
Something, otherwise we get the interference and it affects your story.
Yep.
So how are you going?
Good. Okay. Just another memory to remind me about is my early school day buses.
So let's talk Austria. About the transport. How would you get to school as a little one?
I would walk up to the end of Kookaburra Road, which was only a dirt road in those days, to the Hume Highway. I would then catch the bus from there. I would be the first child on the bus and catch the bus to Austral School. The fact was that we never had sufficient money to pay for the bus, so I did a deal with the bus driver, a fellow called Mr. Winters, who ended up being a very was a mentor in a way. He then got me to, because the buses didn't have doors on them in those days, he would then, and he was also the postman as well, he would deliver the mail. So all the way from, mine was the first pickup, all the way to Austral School, he would drop off the mail. He was getting a bit older and he found it difficult to drop off the mail, so my job became twofold. One, to drop off the mail, and two, to let the kids in, and I would stand at the door so that he would know that it was safe for him to drive off. So that was my job for 5 years till the school, and I can remember him buying me a cricket bat for what I did and then taking me to see West Indies versus Australia at the cricket ground because I never had the opportunity to go to cricket.
That was quite a responsible role too.
Correct.
So you must have been a responsible young person.
That was my problem. I was too responsible. That's the way you grew up. That's the way you grew up. You have to be responsible. Oh, that's the way I was taught.
You were capable of that.
Yeah, I was taught that way. Yeah, and then when I went to school, the first school at Austral.
I'll just stop you. Yeah, we might talk about some of the kids you went to school with.
Yeah, I went there mainly with my cousins and some other people, the Watsons and the Rileys. I went there particularly with Milan Serovic, and one of the first things I learned, I couldn't speak English, and I used to use him as my translator. And one of the first things that they did, the classroom was just the one classroom with the 6 classes in it with the one teacher. And I remember learning that I had to go to the toilet, and I asked Milan what I had to say, and Watson's told him to tell me to say a swear word instead of when I had to go to the toilet. So I put my hand up and I swore, not knowing that I swore. I thought I was asking to go to the toilet. And the reception wasn't very, very, very good. I can remember that. I'll never forget that because I got the cane at the age of 6. And the other thing at school which was really interesting for those days was the milk being dropped off at the school, and you had to have a bottle of milk every morning or at morning too, whether it was cold, hot or indifferent, and a lot of occasions it was off. The other thing that fascinated me about Austral School, we had a headmaster called Mr. Fletcher. He used to get me to drive, get the tractor from my father, and I used to plough the front garden to make the lawn. So that was the extent of my academic education. The other thing that I thought was quite fascinating for those days was the fact that we used to go to the nudist colony in Bringelly Road for swimming every Friday in the summertime.
So they had a pool there.
And we all used to, I can remember all the, but the fascinating thing was the way we got there. There was no buses. Our dads used to bring the truck along. We'd all jump on the back of the truck. And the only stipulation was by the headmaster that the truck had sides on it so that the kids wouldn't fall out as the truck was going there. So every child used to get excited because their dad used to come on the Friday to take their kids to this nudist colony, have their swim, and then bring them back on the back of the truck.
So what did the nudist colony look like? It sounds so exotic.
From the outside, it had a corrugated fence wall. On the inside, it had a pool and then various huts around that pool where the people used to, I imagine, stay during the day. And that was it. That's all I can remember of it.
And did you know who owned that?
I had not. No.
So what is the nudist colony today?
It's the Rebels Bikies own it now. They've owned it for a number of years. Yeah.
What did Austral look like as a young kid?
Austral looked like it had a school on the corner of Edmondson Avenue and 10th Avenue. It had one shop called Herbie Starr's Shop where we used to go to buy our lollies. It was a hardware store. It was everything. It was just a general store. And Herbie Starr was the proprietor, and he used to be the man that we used to play games with, and he used to get upset with us and chase us around. But one thing that I remember was that I happened to have my first girlfriend there was Phyllis, Lorraine Phyllis, who was of the Phyllis trotting people, and they used to have a lovely house and farm just down the road from the school in Edmondson Avenue. So I thought I was acquainted to her anyway. Well, I thought I was creating a relationship. Anyway, I wanted to impress her because I never had any money, so I stole a pound from my parents, took it to Herbie Starr's and shouted everybody lollies, and I thought I was a big man, and then I took their money back and I felt so guilty I hid it under the house, but I could never tell my parents. And then some years later, and that was to impress Lorraine.
How long was that relationship?
Oh, I think about 6 months. When she went to high school, she dumped me.
Do you remember Green Valley being built?
The housing estate?
Do you remember any of that?
I do. I remember a lot of controversy. I can't quite remember the detail of it, but there was a lot of controversy about creating this new township out there that was going to become a ghetto that was being built by the Housing Commission, and it was going to create a ghetto out there of people that I suppose at that time were maybe treated incorrectly, and they were being taken out from the city to the suburbs.
Okay. So Where do you want to go from here? Do you want to go to high school?
Yeah, then I went to high school.
So let's talk about your sporting. Like, so you were an athlete? Were you an elite athlete?
In those days, I wouldn't...
I don't want you to be delusional.
No, really. There was not being elite, it was just something I enjoyed. I enjoyed playing cricket. I knew nothing about it, but I learned very quickly.
What did you like about... Were you a bowler or a batter?
No, I was a wicket keeper and a batsman. And a friend of mine, John Padovan, who was much more advanced than I was in terms of understanding the different specialities of sport, and... He used to teach me how to play cricket. And we used to play games on the weekend. He used to come to my place, I'd go to his. I remember him playing a great shot and breaking the window of our house at one stage. But John mentored me right through. He was 1 year ahead of me at school. Rugby, I used to play soccer. There was a gentleman called Mr. Stojkovic, who owned Belgrade Real Estate. He used to come and collect the kids and take them to soccer because we never had the opportunity of going to football or to soccer. And I used to be a goalkeeper. I used to play out in the field. He said I was no good at that, so he put me in goal and I became a goalkeeper and eventually ended up representing the high school in combined high school sports. I think I was one of the only ones, the first ones to ever do that at Liverpool Boys High.
Interesting that you're a wicket keeper and a goalkeeper.
Yeah, awful stuff.
Or backup. You're always back someone up, wouldn't you?
Yeah. There was interesting times. The other sports that I used to get involved with was that I always used with rugby union in particular, because at my age I was quite strong and bigger than the other kids. So I used to be promoted to the years above me to play in the teams that were doing very well all the way through my schooling. I remember my first attempt at playing rugby in first year at school. There was a fella called Woodward. He actually represented Australia as a breakaway. He took us to Woodward Park, and he got all the kids from in first year on the field, and then put half of them on one side, and then the other half on the other side. Threw the ball in the middle, and he said, "Go for it, boys! You got to get the ball over the line on that side, and that team had to get the ball over the other side." And I happened to, for some reason, come out pretty good out of that. So he selected me in the team. So I started playing rugby. I didn't know what position was what. And he said to me, "You're a centre." I said, "Okay, where's that?" He said, "See that fellow there? His name's Paul Stuxbury. You just chase him around the field. Wherever he goes, you go wherever he goes." So that was my first lesson. And that year I scored a try every match. And we actually were premiers that year. But what was interesting, I had to tell my parents that I was playing rugby union. They didn't think that was a very good idea because I would get injured. And there was a sort of mentality amongst the Yugoslavs at that stage that rugby union was only for the rough boys, not for the sort of, you get very injured. So I was only allowed to play soccer. So my mother gave me a note to take to Mr. Woodward to say that I couldn't play rugby union, that it wouldn't be a good idea. So Mr. Woodward read this note and said to me, "Morris, if you want to be successful in this school, you have to play rugby union because that's the way of the school. You know, that's the premier sport." And so I was left with this dilemma of dealing with this thing at school, and I couldn't go back to my parents and tell them that. So he said, "I'll rip up this note and then you won't be ostracised by the other boys in the school." So he ripped up the net, but I didn't tell my parents. So I used to play for my first year of rugby. I used to play with them, and they didn't know I was playing rugby until I came home with grazed knees, grazed legs, and then my mother eventually worked out that I was playing rugby, not soccer. So, yeah.
Wow. And were there any repercussions from that?
No, Mum sort of, I think, came to terms with it.
So what were you thinking then about your future?
My future?
Well, like at that point in your life, I know it's hard because we don't know a lot of this, but what was...
I wasn't thinking about my future at all. It was just day to day. When was the next rugby game? When was the next soccer game? When was I going to play handball with my mates? When was I going to get into another fight? Whatever the case may be. And trying to get through school, which I wasn't very good at. And, I was school captain in second year in the lower classes. I was in the D classes. And I had all the tough guys in my class. And that was... and I had to deal with that. And I can remember one occasion... in class, I was left to look after the class, and the rough guys from the school were throwing oranges around the classroom while the teacher was out, and I tried to stop them. So they threw an orange at me, and I ducked, and my lip went through my tooth, or my tooth went through my lip, blood everywhere. The teacher came straight in and said, "What's going on?" And he could see blood pouring out of my mouth. I said, "Oh, nothing, nothing. I just went down to pick up a book and I spit, and there's this orange splattered all over the wall on the other side." So he soon worked out that there were some problems, but I had to take the blame. I had to take the heat for that because you never dobbed your mates in those days. Never, ever. Doesn't matter what it was. You never dobbed your mates in. And that's the way I learned. That was the way I grew up. And if you had a fight, you had to stand up for yourself. And whether you lost or won, you'd have to, you never sort of lay down on the ground. You'd always try and show that you took it as a man.
Can we talk about when you met your wife?
When I met my wife? Yes.
Like, how old were you when you met your wife? We're skipping a few years.
24.
Also, quite some time, really, from school.
Yeah. From school, from my years from school to the time I got married were just a very, very exciting time.
Yes.
I used to go to parties. My cousins who were all older than me, used to take me to the hotel at the age of 15.
What hotels did you drink at?
Stardust, the Mains Bridge, the Commercial, the Railway, whichever. They were sort of the years where, you just had a good time. You enjoyed life. You worked hard. You played hard. And
what were you working at? What was your job?
In the market garden.
You were working for your farming?
Yeah, up till high school. And even after high school, I continued helping Dad on the farm. That was just an obligation that you had to do. At the same time, I did an accountancy course when I left school, and I worked. My first job was at the Sydney Water Board in town. I stayed there for 6 months. I had to work for a government job because my parents always considered that government jobs were, because you got sick leave, you got annual leave, you got long service leave, and it was very secure. So that was my. So then I went to Liverpool Council with Ross Craik, who was another local identity. He was the accountant there. I worked in Liverpool Council from 1965 to 1969.
In what department?
From the accounts department to the rates department. And I had a wow of a time. It was a very great social event. Work wasn't a part of it very much.
It's a public service, isn't it?
Yeah.
So who was the mayor then? Who were you working with?
The mayor was Mr. Smith. The town clerk was Reg Finlay, who was a character in the area. Jack Facey was the deputy. There was Peter Standard, who was the head engineer. There was John Crawford, who was the town planner. They're in Moore Street. We were working out of Moore Street, and that was sort of my formative years. The thing that stood out for me was one thing that Ross Craig said: always try and look 5 years ahead, or plan 5 years ahead. And I used to think about that a fair bit. That was the only thing he really taught me. I wasn't a very good accountant, but then I progressed, and I used to date a lot of girls around Liverpool, and then I eventually dated my wife, who was in, she worked for Gus Weitch, who had a travel agency in the arcade at the Carl's Arcade in Liverpool. She struck me because she was very attractive to my eyes. Had long blonde hair, which always sort of fascinated me. And then we met, and I can remember ringing her up and saying, would she like to go for a date? Because I started dating the girls from the beginning of the arcade right through to where I got to her. And she said she would, and she asked me where we were going. I said to the Bankstown Sports Club, or Bankstown Trotting Club, one of the two. And she said, what should I wear? And I said, the shortest dress you can is fine. And anyway, she got over that and came with me, and I had to pick her up in the old ute. And she said, I can remember something, and it's always stuck, something, where are you from or what nationality or something. I just said, I'm a Wog baby, and that's it. And she keeps reminding me of that every time. That was, I think. And then we had a short courtship, and then we got engaged on her 21st birthday.
So she must have impressed you.
She did. She did. She was, and then we got married in 1971, on 17th of the 7th, 71.
And where did you get married?
We got married at the All Saints Church. And my wife wasn't Catholic at the time. She was Protestant, but she converted because that was sort of the way of the thing. And actually, she took it on much more than I did. We had a nuptial mass.
Can I ask your wife's full name? Oh, oh dear.
Dorothea, I can't give her a second name, she'd kill me, Vandenacker.
So, where did she grow up?
She grew up at Ramsgate. She was a very good swimmer, she could have been a champion swimmer. And then they moved to Dunrussell Avenue, that was their first home that they owned. Before that they were renting in Ramsgate. Then she went to Liverpool Girls High. And then she used to swim, be a very good swimmer, and swim with Michael Wendon and Vic Arneil at the time, used to coach her. And had she kept it up, she probably would have been a champion because she was swimming as fast as Wendon was. Then I didn't know her, but she was going to school with my sister, and I think I had vague memories of seeing her at school once, being very thin and slight.
Because she's quite tall, isn't she?
Yeah, but at that time I didn't remember her as being at all. But anyway, I don't know whether it was her or not, but I had this vision later on. And
she
then,
might have grown.
Yeah. Obviously she did. Yeah, so then, we had a pretty good time together. We used to go to a lot of water skiing.
And your children, so let's just log them in. So can you tell me all their names and if you know their date of birth or their year of birth?
Yeah. The first child was Bianca Marina Tulich. She was born in 1974. She grew up at Preston's with us, and then when we moved to Camden, she first went to Preston School, and then when we moved to Camden, went to St Paul's, and then on to John Terry. She's now 37 years of age, and fully pregnant, and about to have her first child on the 27th of December, which we're all looking forward to. Her background is that she became an accountant at the University of Western Sydney, worked with Baz Luhrmann and Cameron McIntosh, Baz Luhrmann, as their financial controller, and is now in partnership with me in building retirement villages and aged care facilities. Next daughter is Jade Ewan Tulich, born in 1976. She is from Korea. She is adopted. She came to us at the age of 5 months. We were advised that Taya and I wouldn't have any more children. And so we decided to adopt. And it was probably the most amazing experience that I have ever had. First of all, when we first got her, we got approved as adoptive parents. And then at that stage, people ask us, why did you go for an overseas baby? But at that stage, you weren't children in Australia. We're not adopted out. You have to wait for at least 9 years. So we decided to go for overseas. It wasn't matter what the child was or who it was, or as long as it was a child, that's what was important to us. So we decided to go overseas, and they allocated South Korea to us. Then within a short time after we were approved, Jade picture was sent to the agency here, and then we were called in, and we saw a picture, and immediately that was our child. Then Teo fell pregnant within about 2 months after that, and we had our third child. But Jade came to us in May, I'll never forget it, May, must have been 77. And we went to the airport, fully pregnant, and picked her up and brought her back. But it was interesting, we had a bit of a hiccup on getting Jade to us, and we went to see Mr. Kieran, who was the MP at the time.
John Kieran.
And he pulled a few strings for us in a normal way, and thankfully to him, we were able to get her out earlier than what was originally anticipated to be about 12 months. We got her out in 5 months. And that became probably the most valuable experience to me, apart from having your own children, as being amazing. And if I could do it again, I would do it again.
So what is that experience, Maurice? Because you're quite clearly touched.
The experience is just the child being from somewhere else, and then her... growing in her own way with us, and then also understanding her, must be her emotional situation, where she realises she's somebody different, yet she's a part of that same family. And we were able to overcome that really well with her, because we always, whenever we met somebody, we would always say, this is our daughter, rather than just saying this is Jade, so people wouldn't have any doubt in their own mind. She's now married. She's 32, fully pregnant, and about to have her first child in April.
She's going to be busy.
And
I just know somewhere in there that you... How did you raise the money for Jade?
Yeah, that was interesting. Taya, I must give it to Taya. She was, at the time... I was working, and she used to tend to the zucchinis, and we planted a patch of zucchinis, and that we had to get $1,500 together to be able to pay for her fare out. We made, I think, $900 out of the first patch, and Taya worked hard out in getting that, and then we had another patch, and we had to get another $600 together to... And unfortunately, we were wiped out by hail, and Taya thought that would be the end, we wouldn't make it. There was tears by everybody. But somehow we accumulated the other, I don't know where it came from, but we got it together and paid the bill, paid the airfare, and she came out. Yeah. But that was, we worked our hearts out. Taya would tend to the zucchinis, pick them, then night time I'd pack them and take them to the market. So, but it was fun. It was fun.
Extraordinary story. Yeah. So, okay, so we'll just give, I just remember that being mentioned at some point since meeting you. And so Jade's expecting a baby, and your other children.
Yeah,
they must
tomorrow.
Have been like twins almost.
They were. We would carry, we had a twin strollers. And one would be Korean on one side and one white on the other side. So people used to be fascinated. They'd stop us in the street, particularly the older women, and try and work it out, and then we'd explain it. But it was good. We were never, ever, I don't think she's ever been, felt that she's never been part of our family, so that's been good. And the other kids have been fantastic with her, and they're still today sisters and brothers as if You know, there was no difference, which is fantastic. Then came Tamara, who's our academic. She was born in 77, and she was always excelled academically at school, first at St Paul's, first at Preston's and then to St Paul's, and then from St Paul's to John Terry. At the age of 15, she wanted to go and live in a country that was cold, had a cold climate. I don't know where that came from. So she became an exchange student and went to Finland, spent 12 months at the age of 15 in Finland, came back 16, much more mature, much more worldly, went on to high school, graduated, and now she's got 3 degrees. She's got a solicitor, a lawyer's degree. Now she's doing a doctorate in law as well.
With refugees, is that right?
No, she's doing terrorism since 7/11.
And so she where's she studying, at Oxford or somewhere?
No, she's studying at University of New South Wales. She's got 2 years, 1 year to go. She just came back from Milan and Oxford in presenting papers over there, which is part of her doctorate.
And your son?
Son came along in 79.
Well, doctors didn't get it right, did they?
No. Or was it 78? What is it now?
11.
Must be 79. He also graduated from University of Canberra. He went to school at St Paul's. He had an illustrious career of lack of discipline at school. Always in trouble. We ended up going to Hurlston. St Greg's.
Is he a bit like you?
I'd probably say he's a bit like me. Physically, he's more on his mother's side, but probably his personality is very similar to mine. Loves his sport. He graduated, but wasn't physically developed at the stages of school that I was. He matured much later. He was a very slight boy, but tall, gangly. Got through high school and then didn't know what he wanted to do, came to work for me when I started building Blue Hills, saved up $6,000 or $7,000 in 6 months. To his credit, he showed me that he could work very hard because he was doing tiling and the fellow didn't want him to leave because he was doing such a good job. He went, got a Contiki tour, went overseas and came back a different person. Said I was going to university, went to Canberra and hasn't returned home. He graduated, started a personal training business, didn't like what he graduated in, so he started a personal training business down in Canberra, is still doing that, and is married now 3 years, I think, to a lovely girl called Emma.
So the inspiration moving into... So tell me about what you do today and your business.
Today we build, operate and manage retirement villages and aged care facilities. It was always... How I entered into it was a bit by accident. What happened was I bought 16 acres off my grandfather in 1968. He used that to go back to Yugoslavia. That was sort of his superannuation, and he kept 5 acres and a house. I bought that land in 68, but I farmed it and lived on it, but never did anything else. But I had a vision. I didn't want to ever get rid of it. I didn't ever want to just sell it, but I could see that residential housing was going to come to that area. I didn't see us being successful as market gardeners, and my uncle also had that same aspiration. So
your Uncle Peter?
Uncle Peter. So the only way that these people, even my dad, could make any money and for their retirement, because they had no superannuation policies, was to get the value out of the land. As it was, there was hardly any value in it. But as residential, I could see that there was potential, even though my dad fought against me on that because he felt that the market gardening was the only way to go in life. But my uncle was the opposite. He wanted it rezoned to residential so that he could get his value out of the land, which was fair enough, and so should he get that. For me, it was slightly different. I facilitated that process, but I still wanted to maintain some of the land in the Toolage name. And I worked for a company that manufactured hospital furniture and nursing home furniture. So I saw a lot of nursing homes. And also my grandfather used to come up and when he came back from Yugoslavia and assist me with the tomatoes or cabbages that I was growing to supplement my income. And he said to me one day, would you, if ever you can do anything with this land, do it for the old people? And I said, why? And he said, well, I've been isolated. I've got no social connections unless I've got to go through my children or my grandchildren. It never sort of clicked. I just sort of thought about it. Anyway, as I was becoming more involved in the business that I was working for, Murphy Furniture in Chipping Norton, people used to ring me up and ask me about retirement villages or aged care where they could put their parents or their uncles or aunties. They, for some reason, felt that I knew where these places were. Then, going around and seeing it, I looked at a map and I could see all the aged care facilities and retirement villages that weren't of a religious bent on the north side of Parramatta Road. Nothing very much on the south side. So I decided that would be a good idea to build a retirement village at Preston's, when the residential. And I also felt that if I got the retirement village approved, it would then bring urbanisation to where we were. So I started on 1989 to think about building a retirement village there. And it was a very stressful process. I went through 9 years at fighting Liverpool Council to get it approved. They thought I was going to create this enclave of old people and just leave them there and run off and make all these millions. Anyway, I went through various processes, court cases and so forth. But eventually we got the rezoning through, and therefore when we got the rezoning through, they couldn't knock the retirement village back. And that happened in 1996, and I ended up building it in 1999. And then I really, in this process of learning about aged care and retirement, I had to find out, because I knew nothing about it. And then I developed this passion. I could feel this passion that retirement and aged care in the community was pretty hopeless, pretty bad. You had no choice. You lost your independence, you lost your dignity, and you were treated like a person that was about to die. And that's all you had to look forward to. So I felt that that could be done differently. I learned a lot from my grandfather. He kept on living on even though he was retired and enjoying life. But he didn't have the social infrastructure to be able to facilitate that. So, and I saw all these retirement villages starting to develop, and I studied what was happening in America, Europe, Canada, and I couldn't see why it couldn't be done here. And some of the religious organisations were doing it, but very crudely. So I thought to myself, well, you know, we can do this better. And so I decided to do it, and I went for it. Everybody told me I was going to be a failure. It was going to be a disaster. Nobody would want to live out there. Nobody would want to spend money to be a retiree. They all wanted to live off the government.
These are other businessmen?
Yes. Banks, the industry experts. So I went against that, even against my wife in going ahead and building it, because she felt I was pushing the boundaries too much. And we didn't have very much money at all. And we had four kids, and I was going to lose everything. So I facilitated various ways of, I sold off half my land, moved my wife and myself over to Camden so that she would be satisfied in the schooling for the children. And then I decided, then I continued on with the developing of the balance of the land. So then we finally got it approved and started building in 1999. We had difficulty getting money from the normal institutions because of all the bad press, and I had no record, no history in that industry. I finally caught up with a developer, a South African guy called Curtis Mann. We developed this plan. We got some money from a second board lender up in Queensland, the White Shoe Brigade. We spent a lot of time in planning, which was one thing that because I had no expertise, I had the vision, but no building expertise. So that's where Curtis came into. He was a developer from the Sydney. So we planned and planned and finally got it sorted the way we wanted it. I always believed in a continuum of care, where you started off from independent living into aged care of sorts. I wasn't quite sure when we first started how that was going to work. But we had to get going because we were spending all this money in the development stage. We had to recoup it. So we eventually got going and we decided to build which was a boon because I don't know how we decided to do that. But anyway, we decided to build a exhibition home to show people what it could be, and we decided to give people choice. We developed this fantastic brochure and tried to change the whole way of doing things and giving the people the ability to come and see what they were going to buy and choose what colours they want. We had this amazing advertising campaign set up to get going. I can remember sitting with Taya and this girl that used to work with me at Murphy Furniture, sitting in a mate's office in Liverpool, thinking, wow, how are we going to sell this? There's 13 acres. Who's going to buy these things? Nobody knows anything about retirement in the western suburbs. Nobody knows. You know, they all think that you're going to take their money and they're going to end up with nothing. So anyway, we started building, and we sent out our first these letters, mail drop letters to everybody. We had something like 500 people reply.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, it was.
For that type of marketing.
Yeah. We were going to send out 21. We only ended up sending out 9,000, and the balance we never ever ended up sending out. And we got such a response. I think everybody knew of the Tulich name. I think that was, you know, from my parents, not so from myself and my uncle. So people trusted us, which was rather incredible. And a lot of the people that moved in knew of the Tuliches in the past. And when we first started, we had the building half built, and there was people knocking the door down, and we weren't ready to start selling. So the first people that moved in were the Murphy sisters. There were three Catholic school teachers, and they moved from Kasula to the village. But we just couldn't have the house ready in time. There was raining. Everything was against us. Anyway, we finally got it up and they moved in. And then we couldn't get the... Everything was pre-sold. We were building these houses and we couldn't finish them. But people were selling their houses much quicker than we were building. So we had to put them up in motels until we had the houses finished. Anyway, after we finished the first stage, the fellow that was funding us from Queensland flew us up to Queensland and said, I want to buy your village. And we said, how much? And, you know, we thought he was going to give us this massive check. But anyway, it wasn't sufficient to ask us to change over. So we flew back again and feeling pretty cool about ourselves. You know, we were able to pay our debts back. I'd sold my house to finance all this. My wife was pretty uptight with me about it, which is understandable.
Extraordinary stress.
Yeah. And I thought I was going to lose everything. And then it's turned out that we actually were being very successful. And then this fellow who was funding us stopped paying the builder because he was going to choke us out of it, and he wanted to. He could see the end more than we could. And anyway, we went to court. We won the court case. The builder actually went with the finance company, thinking that he was a stronger party. So we had to kick him off site. We locked him off site. I can remember standing there with all the fences closed and all the contractors coming, and I had to turn them away. And they were getting very aggressive with me because they hadn't been paid, not by us, but by the builder. We were paying the builder. And then we had to get these other builders to come on while the other builder was fighting us in court about the way we put him off the job. And we ended up building. We won the court case there as well. We ended up going with Bank of New Zealand. They funded us right through. We paid them back within, I think it was a couple of years straight after we'd finished. But during that stage, we were actually had service departments allocated to build, and I could see that to do this continuum of care properly, I had to become an aged care operator as well. So I had to become an approved provider, and then we had to bid for licenses, which we got. And Blue Hills is now Blue Hills, 152 IOUs and 67 bed residential aged care and community care, and going gangbusters. And it's not the buildings, it's the people and the lifestyle that they lead there.
So just on that point, and I just want, you got sick at some point.
That's unbeknownst to me, I had bowel cancer. I went to have a colonoscopy, and this was in October 2004, which was our official opening. I actually put off the colonoscopy till after the official opening, so I went to the official opening, which was a fantastic success. Then I went and had my colonoscopy, and on the Wednesday after the Friday of the official opening, and they found that I had cancer, unbeknownst to me. I was put on the table. And when I woke up, my wife was there, my kids were there, and the doctor was there. And I'm saying, what's going on? They said, you've got cancer. You have to go back at 6 o'clock and be operated on, and the cancer cut out, which I went and did. And then I had 6 months of chemo.
So how was that?
That was the most horrible experience I could ever have. Chemotherapy was an absolute, it was just, it's indescribable. The feeling that you get, I'd have 5 days of chemo, then I'd have 3 weeks off, and then I'd have another 5 days. I never ever felt psychologically that I was going to die or anything like that. I never had that feeling. I always felt that I was going to be, I was going to continue to live, and you know, it was just going to be one of those things that happens in your life. Mm-hmm. But the chemo drained me, drained my energy. I also was going through a few difficulties with my partners at the retirement village, which was also making it hard for me. But as my dad would say, you just keep going, you don't stop. So I did that. I was going to give up chemo because I couldn't take it anymore. It used to drain me so much. It used to take all my energy out of me. But my family convinced me that I should continue it, and I did. Got through it, and then went away for a bit of time to recuperate. And, yeah, it's all history now, 7 years ago. So I'm past the 5 year, which is supposed to be very critical in this type of cancer. If you get past the 5 years, you've got a very good chance of continuing.
So over that period, once you stopped the chemo and you had a rest, you would have obviously had some time to catch up with yourself and reflect on the future, on the next part of it, the journey with this, or was that...
Yeah, it was interesting. I'm not sort of a person that dwells on the past or dwells on, you know, something that might be wrong with me. I'll continue. So this property, I
had... Because your family had land at Menangle.
No.
Oh.
That was different.
Ah.
What happened was the land at Menangle was owned by a friend of mine, Tick Stoygibbage, who I grew up with. He's a solicitor in Liverpool. he wanted to sell this land, and he came to me and asked me would I be interested. I came out and saw it, and I saw the potential of it as being a retirement village. So I said yes, I'd be interested in buying it. So I bought it off him, and then because it was rural at that stage, but I knew that there was an opportunity because of the way the Act was written, the planning policy, that we could get it approved as a retirement village, which we did through Wollondilly Council, and then started building it, and we're two-thirds of the way through.
And how would you compare your experience with that council to the other council? Was it a different experience?
It was totally different because I had now had a history or a record of being a good developer, a good operator, and I was genuine, and everybody could see what I was, the end vision, which I could see at the beginning, but they couldn't. In the case of Liverpool Council, whilst they were the worst people I had, the most difficult people in the first stages, they then ended up using Blue Hills as any time any overseas visitor would come to Liverpool, they would then bring them out to Preston's to show them the retirement village. So it became an interesting. They became my friends. Yes. They could see the vision then. And it's fortunately the planner who worked at Liverpool Council where we were getting the approvals through, moved to Wollondilly Council, unbeknownst to me, and he knew my history, so it made it a lot easier. And Wollondilly Council were probably a bit more open. They were prepared to, they needed development in there. They could see the need for aged care and retirement.
So where else are you at the moment? You're mm-hmm. expanding.
Yeah, I'm expanding under a different structure with my daughter in Dubbo. We're doing a joint venture up there for 152 independent living units. We're also doing a joint venture in Fig Tree for an aged care facility. We've got 15 beds which are operating at the moment. It's a completely completely extra service facility, which is not something that many people have in Australia. It's a total of 81 beds, and we have got a 66 bed facility being building next door, which will open up in April. And Bianca looks after that as well.
And what's that facility?
The Hillside at Fig Tree.
Oh, yeah.
And it's built on the old BHP executive accommodation site in Fig Tree.
So what's the next 5 years?
The next 5 years for us is we're presently negotiating with Penrith Leagues Club to build an aged care and retirement village there. We're also presently got land up in Mayfield and Newcastle, which we're about to develop. And we've got other people that are presenting us with opportunities, but we are picking and choosing those opportunities, mainly where we're providing the expertise and they provide the land. So, and then we end up doing a joint venture. But it's all in, mainly all in New South Wales at the moment. We also do community care packages for the Aboriginal people in Moonee Moonee, which is near Coffs Harbour. We were asked by the health department, nobody would take it on, to develop with the Aboriginal people, or the Indigenous people, as I should call them, in Moonee Moonee. And we did that, and it's now very successful in operating 20 community care packages up there.
With the Aboriginal project, I said, do you want to be called Indigenous or Aboriginal? And they said, Aboriginal.
Oh, okay. My daughter picks me up all the time.
So
I'm sorry.
They said, oh, don't worry about Indigenous. That was at Liverpool, though. So, I just thought I'd share that with you.
Thanks.
What was I going to say? Okay, so I know we'll probably wind up soon because I know you're busy, and we can go on another time and cover anything later. But clearly there is, and you're hungry, clearly there's...
sorry.
No, don't be sorry. You have an ethic, and obviously you have an integrity. And I suppose I'm interested in hearing what some of your true core values are that you live, because you live who you are and you live what you say.
Yeah. My core values are basically family, hard work, as honest as you can be with people, loyalty, and as ethical as you can be. It's difficult in this world today, particularly when you're dealing with so many different levels of government. And that's one of the difficulties of this industry, is the amount of people that you have to deal with. But to house people of this who are vulnerable, particularly as the aged are, then you've got to have those values. If you don't, we always look at our residents first, our staff second, and ourselves third, and that's the way it goes, and that's the ethics. And I'm very much a hands-on person. I won't ask anybody to do anything that I wouldn't do myself, and that means cleaning, whatever it takes. Shoveling, whatever. If I ask my people to do it, I would do it myself. So that's basically what I'm about.
And who are some of your best mates? Who are people that you walk with?
The people I walk with, particularly in my and they're still with me from school days, are Ron Majoran, Tik Stojkovic, John Padovan, Roy Zizic, Val Zaitz. They're probably the most ones that I went to school with, and they continue to still be friends. But we don't have to be in each other's pocket. We go fishing, we do things as it may be. But they're probably the people I can depend on in time of need. My brother also, Tony, is very. We sort of bounce off each other a fair bit.
Because he's retired now,
isn't he? Yeah, and he's younger than me. How did he work that out? But I'll never retire. I don't see myself as retired. I just couldn't sit at home. And
I can relate to that too.
But I'll always be doing something. So, but I enjoy it. So, and that's if I enjoy it, I'll do it, and I enjoy what I do. So.
And you're about to be a grandfather.
Yeah, which is really exciting. Something that I'm probably the eldest in the family, but the last one to have a grandchild. So. Be interesting times. Taya is very much over the moon at the moment, but as long as the baby's healthy and happy, and that'll be fine.
All right. Are we going to leave it there today?
Yeah, if you want. Yeah. Okay. Wow.